Chapter 10. Ocean Wanderer was now totally helpless. Free of her moorings, the floating hotel was at the full mercy of the hurricane's assault. There was nothing left the men could do to save the guests and the hotel. Morton was becoming more desperate by the minute. He faced one critical decision after another. He could either order the ballast tanks filled to higher levels, settling the hotel lower in the water to lessen the rate of drift under the vicious gale, or empty the tanks and allow the waves to toss the luxury structure and its passengers about like a house in a Kansas tornado. On the face of it, the first option seemed the most practical. But that meant a battering by an irresistible force against a nearly immovable object. Already, sections of the hotel were giving way, allowing flooding into the lower levels that pushed the pumps to their limits. The second option would mean extreme discomfort for everyone on board and speed up the inevitable impact on the Caribbean island's rocky coast. He was about to opt for filling the tanks to the brim when the wind suddenly began to slacken. After half an hour, it almost died away completely, and the sun beamed down on the hotel. People in the ballroom and theater started to cheer, believing the worst of the storm was over. Morton knew better. True gale winds had decreased, but the sea was still rough. Looking through the salt-stained windows, he could see the gray inner walls of the hurricane soaring into the sky. The storm was moving directly over them, and they were now in the hurricane's eye. The worst was yet to come. In the few short hours remaining before the eye passed, Morton called together all his maintenance people and every able male employee and passenger. Then he divided them up into work parties, assigning some to repair the damage and others to shore up the lower-level windows that were badly leaking and ready to give way. They labored heroically, and soon their efforts paid off. The flooding decreased, and the pumps began to gain on the leaks. Morton realized they had merely gleaned a temporary reprieve as long as they remained in the eye, but it was vital to keep up morale and assure everyone they had a fighting chance of survival, even though he didn't believe it himself. He returned to his office and began studying charts of the Dominican Republic shoreline, attempting to predict where the Ocean Wanderer might be driven ashore. With luck, they could be forced onto one of the many beaches, but most were too small, some even blasted out of the rock to build hotel resorts. The best estimate was that they had a 90% chance of striking rocks created out of volcanic lava many millions of years ago. In his worst nightmare, Morton could not conceive how he could remove 1,000 human beings from the battered hotel and transport them safely to land while it was being bashed by giant waves against unyielding rocks. There seemed no way of avoiding a terrible fate. He had never felt so vulnerable, so impotent. He was rubbing his tired and reddened eyes when his communications operator burst through the door. "Mr. Morton, help has come," he shouted. Morton looked at him blankly. "A rescue ship?" The operator shook his head. "No, sir, a helicopter." Morton's brief optimism sank. "What good is a single helicopter? They radioed that they were going to lower 2 men onto the roof." "Impossible." Then he realized that it was possible, as long as they were in the hurricane's eye. He rushed past the operator and stepped into his private elevator, taking it to the roof of the hotel. As the doors opened and he walked out onto the roof, he was dismayed to find the entire sporting complex had been swept away, leaving nothing but the swimming pool. He was especially horrified to see that the life rafts had all vanished. Now that he had a clear 360-degree view of the inner hurricane, he stood awestruck at the sheer, malevolent beauty of it all. Then he looked straight up and saw a turquoise-colored helicopter descending down on the hotel. He could see the word NUMA in bold letters painted on the fuselage. The aircraft paused and hovered 20 feet above the deck as 2 men in turquoise jumpsuits and crash helmets were lowered by cables to the roof of the hotel. Once they disengaged, 2 large bundles wrapped in orange plastic came down on another cable. They quickly disconnected the hook and signaled an all clear. A man inside the helicopter pulled up the cables on a winch and gave a thumbs up sign as the pilot banked away from the hotel and ascended up through the hurricane's eye. Seeing Morton, the 2 visitors approached, easily carrying the bulky bundles. The taller of the 2 removed his helmet, revealing a thick head of black hair graying on the temples. His face was craggy from a life in the elements, and his opaline green eyes, edged in mirth lines, seemed to bore into Morton's brain. "Please take us to Mr. Hobson Morton," he said in a voice strangely calm under the circumstances. "I'm Morton. Who are you and why are you here?" A glove was removed and a hand extended. "My name is Dirk Pitt. I'm Special Projects Director for the National Underwater and Marine Agency." He turned to a short man with dark, curly hair and heavy eyebrows who looked to be descended from a Roman gladiator. "This is my assistant director, Al Giordino. We came to effect a tow for the hotel. I was told the company tugs could not leave port. Not Odyssey tugs, but a NUMA research ship capable of towing a vessel the size of your hotel." Willing to snatch at any straw, Morton motioned Pitt and Giordino into his private elevator and escorted them down to his office. "Forgive the cold reception," he said, offering them a chair. "I was given no warning of your arrival." "We haven't had much time to prepare," Pitt answered indifferently. "What is your current status?" Morton shook his head bleakly. "Not good. Our pumps are barely staying ahead with the flooding. The structure is in danger of collapsing, and once we run onto the rocks surrounding the Dominican Republic..." He paused and shrugged. "Then 1,000 people, including yourselves, are going to die." Pitt's face became as hard as granite. "We're not running on any rocks." "We'll need the services of your maintenance personnel to assist us in hooking up with our ship," said Giordino. "Where is this ship?" Morton questioned, his voice suggesting doubt. "Our helicopter's radar put her less than 30 miles away." Morton looked out the window at the ominous walls surrounding the hurricane's eye. "Your ship will never get here before the storm closes in again." "Our NUMA Hurricane Center measured the eye at 60 miles in diameter and her speed at 20 miles an hour. With a little luck, she'll get here in time." 2 hours to reach us and one to make the hookup," said Giordino, glancing at his watch. "There is, I believe," said Morton in an official tone, "a matter of marine salvage to discuss." "There is nothing to discuss," said Pitt, annoyed at being delayed. "NUMA is a United States government agency dedicated to ocean research. We are not a salvage company. This is not a no-cure, no-pay arrangement. If successful, our boss, Admiral James Sandecker, won't charge your boss, Mr. Spector, one thin dime." Giordino grinned. "I might mention, the Admiral has a love of expensive cigars." Morton simply stared at Giordino. He was at a loss over how to deal with these men who had dropped from the sky unannounced and calmly informed him that they were going to save the hotel and everyone in it. They hardly looked like his salvation. Finally, he acquiesced. "Please tell me what you gentlemen need." The sea sprite refused to die. She went deeper than anyone could have believed a ship would dive and live. Totally immersed, her bow and stern buried deeply in the water, no one thought she could come back. For agonizing seconds, she seemed to hang suspended in the gray-green void. Then slowly, laboriously, her bows began to raise fractionally as she struggled defiantly back toward the surface. Then her thrashing screws dug in and propelled her forward. At last, she burst into the fury of the storm again, her bows thrusting above the water like a porpoise. Her keel crashed down, jolting every plate in her hull that was weighted down with tons of water that flowed across her decks and cascaded back into the sea. The demonic gale had thrown her worst punch at the tough little ship, and she had survived the boiling cauldron. Time and again she had suffered the great swirling mass of wind and water. It was almost as if Sea Sprite had a human determination about her, knowing without reservation that there was nothing left the sea could throw at her that she couldn't brush aside. Maverick stared through the pilot house windshield that had miraculously failed to shatter, his face white as a lily. "That was macabre," he said in a classic understatement. "I had no idea I'd signed aboard a submarine." No other ship could have withstood such a freak occurrence and survived without sinking to the seabed. But Sea Sprite was no ordinary ship. She had been built tough to tolerate massive polar seas. The steel on her hull was far thicker than average to fight the solid mass of ice floes. But she did not escape unscathed. All but one boat had been swept away. Gazing astern, Barnum was amazed that his communications gear had somehow survived. Those who suffered below decks had no inkling how close they came to ending up forever on the bottom of the sea. Suddenly, sunlight beamed into the pilot house. Sea Sprite had broken into Hurricane Lizzie's giant eye. It appeared paradoxical, with a blue sky above and maniacal sea below. To Barnum, it seemed evil that a sight so tantalizing could still be so menacing. Barnum glanced at his communications officer, Mason Jar, who was standing braced against the chart table, gripping the railing with ivory knuckles, looking like he'd seen an army of ghosts. If you can come back on keel, Mason, contact the Ocean Wanderer and tell whoever is in charge that we're coming as quickly as possible through heavy seas. Still dazed by what he had experienced, Jar slowly emerged from shock, nodded without speaking, and walked off toward the communications room as if he was in a trance. Barnum scanned his radar system and studied the blip that he was certain was the hotel 26 miles to the east. Then he programmed his course into the computer and again turned over command to the computerized automated controls. When he finished, he wiped his forehead with an old red bandana and muttered, "Even if we reach her before they go on the rocks, what then? We have no boats to cross over, and if we had, they'd be swamped by the heavy seas. Nor do we have a big tow winch with thick cable." "Not a pretty thought," said Maverick, watching helplessly as the hotel crashes into the rocks with all those women and children on board. "No," said Barnum heavily, "not a pretty thought at all."